Hello, this is Rohit, and welcome to the podcast called Farstar, where I'll be interviewing people, talking to people, having conversations with people about the future of humanity in space. Today, we'll be talking to Jerome Glenn, and I'll let Jerome introduce himself.
I'm Jerome Glenn. I've been doing futures research for about 45 years. I have worked for the Committee for the Future, one of the early think tanks in the future of space. Created my own think tank called the Future Options Room. Worked in international development after that, giving a sort of future spin to things, including getting packet switching into about 30 or 29 or 30 developing countries, which is the backbone that makes internet relatively inexpensive. Then I've also written a couple books on the future of conscious technology, the relationship of consciousness technology, another book on space called Space Trek, The Endless Migration, then another about linking up experimental communities called Linking the Future, which was Orville, Findhorn, and Arcosante linking up. Then I was liaison for the United Nations University between Tokyo headquarters and the United States. And then I created the Millennium Project, which is a global participatory think tank, which I still head. It has 65 nodes around the world that connects local thinking and global thinking. And we produce the State of the Future reports. We've produced them for 22 years. And the current one is the State of the Future 19.1. And we also do the Futures Research Methodology series, which is now version 3.0. It has 37 different methods. It's the largest collection of methods, futures methods in existence, international peer reviewed. Then we also have an online collective intelligence system on the future called the Global Futures Intelligence System. And I go running around giving talks and consulting on stuff and talking to podcasts apparently as well.
I mean, I was fascinated. You said that Space Trek was your first book?
Yes, it was I was working on two other books before that, but I didn't get them published. And the Space Trek was the first one published, right? And my co-author was George Robinson, who unfortunately passed away recently. He got the first PhD in space law. Hmm. So it was an interesting combination of players in the book.
So, and what does the book talk about?
Well, the book was about the big picture of the future of space, the idea that the long-term future for civilization will be leaving the solar system eventually. The sun could have acid indigestion and we could be toast. not only asteroids, there's a lot of other things that could finish us off, not to mention some climate change turning into hydrogen sulfide and poisoning us when we get to 1,000 parts per million. Which is actually a trend forecast to a little bit over 2100. But the idea is, why are we doing space stuff anyway? So it goes into the economics of it to show that it's a net profit because it speeds up industries and new taxes and all that sort of stuff. So the Apollo program in the United States actually was a net profit to the Treasury after 14 years. And if you include state and local taxes, it was a net profit after 9 years. It also gets into the military issues of space. It gets into it was just basically an overview of here are the different elements of coming up in the future of space and also the politics of space as well. And then we also at the end have a sort of a declaration of independence of Earth kind and space kind, because some people will want to stay here for as long as possible and some people want to leave. And the colonial history is not that good, as you know. And so the idea of Earthkind keeping control over Spacekind is not a good idea. So eventually they'll have to declare independence. So that's our last section.
I mean, given what's happening right now, given sort of all the advancements in technology that we've made since we last sent someone to the moon, what's your prognosis about human migration into outer space? Is that imminent? Are we going to see civilization come out in any of kind of the outer space bodies that we have soon, yeah, or is it going to take another 100 years?
Well, to me, it's an inevitability. But you got to remember, engineers, by their nature, are optimists. They say, "I can solve this problem faster than you think." Well, we don't even know the microorganism mix nexus necessary to keep us alive. There's a lot for us to learn to go off into space. One of the big things right now, people are talking about going to Mars. Well, you need something like 6 feet density of regolith, Mars material, to insulate you from the radiation. There's a tremendous amount to learn. But the nice thing is that you've got India involved in the space program now, and you've got China involved in the space program, as well as Russia, Europeans, and the Americans. So the world is slowly moving in that direction. I don't think space migration is imminent, but I think it is in our long-term future, is inevitable. If we believe that life is a good thing and we want to preserve it, if that's true, then we do have to leave the solar system sooner or later. Now, someone says, well, you know, you're looking at, you know, billions of years. Well, not necessarily. The big red giant is not necessarily the thing that would finish us off. There's a lot of things that could finish us off long before the sun turns into a red giant. In any case, we don't know how long it's going to take. We don't know how much we got to learn. So we might as well begin to work on it now. And many, as I mentioned, countries are beginning to work on it slowly but surely. It's a positive driving force of future for anybody that's ever been around any space folks. They're all very uplifting and positive sort of folks. They're on the road to do something. And because it's exciting to think about completely new ways of being, whereas keep repeating the same arguments of racism and sexism and all the rest of that stuff going on the planet, you know, it's a little depressing. So the space stuff gives us a lift. There was just the recent celebration of the anniversary, 50th anniversary of the moon landing. Well, I went down to the mall in Washington, D.C. They did a projection of the Saturn V rocket on the mall at nighttime. It was very quite exciting. And you had people there. I think there were more people there than actually at the presidential inauguration. No one sort of quite said that, but it was really crowded. The whole mall was crowded with people. And people were excited. And here it is 50 years later, and they're still excited. So I think I'd like to see politicians, you know, unabashedly saying, look, space is part of our future. One of the things that used to drive me nuts is that NASA would say, well, you know, the rocket weighs so many tons and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And we're going to make communications. But look, tell people the truth. This is our long-term direction. It may take thousands of years. We don't know how long it's going to take. But that's the direct, that's where we're going. And when people have a sense of the long-term direction, there's a reason to collaborate. Right now, we have no long-range direction agreement on the planet. And we need that for peace, prosperity, and all those nice things.
And then do you think, like, you know, once we inhabit, let's say, the moon, or inhabit Mars, do you think there is a possibility that A, we will sort of in a few generations be a completely different species, and B, once we are so different, that it'll naturally lead to some kind of a conflict?
Yeah, good questions. It is normal for an organism to adapt to its environment. That's sort of biology 101. Now, right now, the idea is we want to change the space environment to be as Earth-like as possible, so we don't have to change too much. Some of the space designs in the center point, we have rotation. You have sort of neutral gravity. Going further out to the rotation, you have more gravity. So I can see people eventually, depending on how big these free space communities would be, to being living and being in different amounts of gravity, or the simulation of gravity, at different times in the day or different times of their life or whatever. Obviously, guys like me that are older than 21, my vertebrates are crushing down. So I'm actually shorter today than I was when I was 20. I might want to be in the free space area more to get my vertebrates to you know, expand out a little bit. I'm not sure. There may be all kinds of benefits in different kinds of gravity. Some people even argue that gravity is kind of a vitamin, not in the usual sense of a vitamin, but a vitamin in the sense that we need it. Mm-hmm. We know that astronauts come back down, and they're sort of like a bit of a biological mess a bit. after being in Reykjavik for so long. They got to readjust, and they have to have exercises while they're up there. But I think that there will be those that will figure out how to make environments in space as Earth-like as possible. And but we will probably speciate. We will probably, as we get more and more time spent in gravity-free environments, we will evolve. We may also, there may, we wrote 1,000-year scenarios back for the year 1999 to celebrate 2000. And one of the scenarios was the idea that human species speciates into a range of things from the pure naturals, who haven't changed their DNA or anything as much as possible, the naturals, all the way out to nanites, which is basically some human intelligence into micro robot things, and a whole range of different kinds of humans between those two extremes. We're already beginning to become quasi-cyborgs. I mean, glasses are the early example. Neuralink with Elon Musk may be another one. Charge coupled or contact lenses for our eyeballs or maybe another one. We may. It does seem that, that we will move toward the direction of cyborgs, but that's adapting to Earth. We may eventually be doing that off in space. And in the long-term future, I think that would be we might even conceivably, with a cyborg relationship, adapt to free space. And that's, you know, way far out. But if you apply the basic principle that life adapts to its environment, then eventually beyond the solar system, we may evolve to how to be in free space somehow. I don't know whether that's amalgamations of humans or what, I don't know.
So what's your favorite movie then? What's your favorite space movie?
Well, I like the original groundbreaking one, which was 2001 A Space Odyssey, simply because one, it was the first movie where people saw space on a big screen before they saw it on a little TV set. And we anybody into media knows that a big screen has a bigger effect than a small screen. And so 2001 was a worldwide effect. I mean, I remember being in Malawi right afterward, and taxi cab drivers were asking things like, "What do you think about that final scene? What did it mean?" I mean, the world was waking up to the idea that we may become a space-faring species. So I would say that's one of them. Star Trek, of course, as I've just sent you a little note beforehand, I was involved in the White House briefing gave the White House briefing that got the Enterprise.
Yes, what was that briefing about?
Yeah, the idea, and you can share that with anybody, it's public stuff. By the way, people can see the Enterprise, the Space Shuttle Enterprise in New York City. They have it there on an aircraft carrier, the Intrepid. And on the body of it is the actual briefing that I sent you. I think the actual one is in their vault. Was a copy. The idea was, though, Star Trek fans have different organizations. And one of their organizations, a couple of their organizations, said we ought to connect more properly NASA issues with Star Trek fans. Because a lot of Star Trek fans didn't know about the Jupiter Orbital Probe or the Deep Space there's a lot of stuff about, because NASA did not have a real lobby. As much as there was one, I was involved in it with a committee for the future, but it wasn't really a lobby. There wasn't, I mean, you had the aerospace industries, but they're lobbying for their own particular products. But the idea of having a space lobby didn't really exist. And so the Star Trek community was a potential lobby for space in NASA, but it didn't know it. It was unknown. So how do you connect them up? So I was asked to go to a little meeting about this to discuss about whether we should give a plaque to Wernher von Braun. And I said, no, Wernher von Braun has so many plaques he can fill up a museum. That will not make a difference. Let's learn from history. If you go back to the early Egyptian time when they united Upper and Lower Egypt, what did they do? They took the archetype images of the crown and the seat and all kinds of stuff, and they put them together. They had the images of north and south or the upper and lower and put them together into one system. I said, okay, what's the number one image, issue, icon of the space program? At that moment, coming up was the space shuttle. And then, okay, now what's the number one icon of the Star Trek community? The Enterprise. So stick them together. And that's why we created a write-in campaign to have people name the first space shuttle the Enterprise. And the letters were pouring in, but the White House didn't know about it because they would come to the White House, but then they were immediately sent over to NASA. so much came in that NASA called me up and said, can you stop this write-in campaign? And, you know, anyway, but so I did the briefing. The briefing is what got the decision. Although people think that it was a write-in campaign that did it, but it would have if my briefing had failed. So the write-in campaign was a backup. But nevertheless, it was fine to think that people could write in and get something out of the space program they wanted. So the whole idea of it was to unite the Star Trek community with space issues, and it was successful.
Another thing that reminded me, that he mentioned to me was this quaint project about going out and mining moon rocks and selling them as jewelry.
Oh yes, that can still be done. All right, so that your listeners know, there was a man named Earl Hubbard and Barbara Hubbard. They're a couple. He was a space artist and she was sort of a space philosopher. And they wanted to get humanity to grow up. And their thought was that humans won't really fully mature until they leave the dependence of the Earth. In the same way that humans will not mature until they leave the zygote, grow up, and leave home, right? You know,
this is the 70s. Is this in the 70s?
Yeah, this is in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, right. And so they said, well, how are we going to get this done? And so they said, well, you can't, you know, governments, you know, they're going to be doing the government program, but there ought to be a citizens space program independent of government, just like there's a citizens things for all kinds of stuff. So they said, well, how are you going to fund it? And somebody got the idea, and I don't know who had the idea first, to buy a Saturn V rocket launch from NASA and send a couple of astronauts up there to collect a bunch of moon rocks, bring them back to the Earth, break them up into small pieces for jewelry, and sell the jewelry at a high price. And that would be funding the next set of launches so that you would be, in a sense, bootstrapping or funding the citizens program by citizen sales of moon rocks or moon jewelry. And so the Barbara Hubbard and then John Whiteside went to NASA and said, we want to buy a Saturn V launch. Well, NASA had no idea what the hell to answer. I mean, they don't do that sort of stuff. We don't contract out to citizens. they wouldn't do it. But now you have citizens programs going on. You've got the Amazon guy and the Elon Musk guy and Sir Richard Branson guy and some others will probably come in as well. That they could take up that old study and they could do it. There's nothing to stop that from being done today.
Thank you for listening. That was the end of the podcast. There were bits of the podcast which I had to leave out for the sake of time, but which I might add later on as an addendum to the podcast. If you enjoy the podcast and you would like me to carry on, let me know. If there are specific people you'd like me to talk to, let me know as well. Thank you.